Welcome to the Ministry Collaborative Podcast,
an ongoing conversation
with ministry leaders
about embracing complexity
and uncertainty
with joy
and faithfulness.
Hi, this is Mark Ramsey, and I'm here with my colleagues Jennifer Watley Maxell, Amy Valdez Barker, and Ryan Bonfilio. We're half of our team. Both this and the next podcast are going to take up the question, what's at stake in this season? Some call it Advent, some call it waiting for incarnation, but what is at stake in this season as we try to sort through all the noise and distraction and try to get to something that is meaningful? How do you all take that?
One of the things that's really at stake is this revelation of new hope. Hope for life, hope for the future, hope for possibilities. I have a newly minted 21-year-old in my life and a child who is also growing up really quickly. And all around them, I hear of this sense of fear and despair because of what's happening out there. You know, I mean, with the wars that are going on, with this loneliness epidemic amongst them, with all of the things that they are wondering about, you know, what's life for? Meaning, purpose. So I think for us, what's at stake is this reminder and this revelation of who God is, and are we actually listening or searching for the voice of God anymore in the midst of all that's going on in the despair of the world? So for me, it's a revelation of the desire to search for God again, to discover God again.
Amy, that links up a lot with what I've been thinking about. We often understand this last month of the year, December, as an ending. It's the time we try to cram all of the last things in before the calendar clicks over to the new year. Our budgets, our to-do lists at work, even our festivities and family gatherings. But I always remember that Advent is a beginning. It's the beginning of the church calendar. It's the beginning of something new. And so there's this misalignment in our calendars between this season that's supposed to represent a new beginning and a new start and our typical thinking of wrapping things up. And I want to lean more into this idea of this season being one that moves in the direction of newness, of new hope, of new patterns, of new ways of being together, of new ways of doing church. I think Advent gives us this gift of a new start, and it's one I want to take more seriously this season.
Yeah, so for me, I think we're really fighting for the soul of the church. I do think that in this season, people are yearning for something deeper. People are looking for meaning. People are trying to figure out where they are and how they got where they are and how they get out. And I think that we keep giving them comfort food. You know, we keep reading them the comfort psalms and we keep wanting to just kind of hold their hand and just bear it. We'll get through this. We'll get through this. And I think what undergirds that is this kind of scarcity and fragility that is not rooted in the gospel. The gospel is, when we look at how the church started, it uprooted systems. It uprooted empires. It turned the world upside down. It is not fragile. It is not scarce. And I think that people are seeing through the fact that this thing that we're offering them, the words sound good, but in the terms of how we live it out, it's not aligning. And so I think people want something new, but just not new in the terms of like the new fangle, the next new thing, the new fad. They don't want a new program. They don't want us to reboot Bible study. They want real deep revelation, introspection, meditation. So I think it's, we're really wrestling for the soul of the church.
Jennifer, your question that you pose, that people are asking, how did we get to where we are? That's a cultural tell, because I think people are at a place that they don't really understand how they got there. Over the Thanksgiving weekend, I read an article by three economists basically taking issue with the fact that everyone's so grumpy all the political and national polls are bad about the future. The amount of people in an older generation who think their children will have it better than they did has plunged almost 20% in the last 4 years. It's to an all-time low. But what the economists were saying was, but look at all the data. Things are all moving in the right direction. That old adage, you can't put data into a feeling system. And I think people are perplexed. And I want to underline that I think that culture is serving up lots of junk food to just fill that and distract us from actually going to a place that we might begin to understand that. But I think inherent in that is, and inherent in the Advent and incarnational texts is, to follow this God who deals with humanity in this way means that things are going to be disrupted and dislocated. And are we up for that?
Yeah, Mark, I think you bring up a compelling point. And I think part of what the challenge is that we have been conditioned to trust the data more than we've been conditioned to trust the divine. And I think that's a discipleship issue. Data is nothing without interpretation. Data is nothing without discernment and revelation. Data is nothing without us meditating on it. Now, of course, the world doesn't use that terminology when they talk about the ways that they assess data, but that is how we spiritually as Christians are supposed to assess data. And I think part of the challenge is that people are not feeling up to the task of assessing the data that is coming at us from all different directions.
I mean, I think our reflection of data also reflects sort of a worldview of data, right? And we keep looking at it from a, well, what does success look like? And what does growth look like? As you were saying, Mark, like all of the data is pointing towards what kind of success? Are we talking about the world's success? Or are we talking about the incarnational Christ's success? Because if you remember, I mean, the Advent story is Jesus coming into the world in the most unlikely, most humble places and spaces that would not be termed in our world a successful king's entry into the world, right? It's a stable surrounded by lots of smelly animals in a place that nobody would have wanted to go. Nobody would have wanted to be there. And yet, here we are, worshiping the divine entry into the world, the beginning, in such a humble way. So what is success? Like you were saying, Jennifer, what is our world's interpretation of the data in a way that really puts the lens of Christ back as the forefront of it? What are we looking at? And why are we looking at it from the reflection of the world? Why aren't we looking at it from the reflection of the divine, trusting the vision of God in all that we do?
Well, I want to drill down on this a little bit more. I mean, Mark, you started this with this idea that the data is all positive in terms of economy and things like that, and yet our feeling is still overwhelmingly negative or grumpy. And of course, no one in the Ministry Collaborative has ever been accused of being grumpy. Let's just make that clear. So I want to know, like, what's going on with that? Why is it that we're looking at positive data through a negative lens? And how would the Christian worldview actually change that? It's not actually clear to me what's happening there and what we're seeing. What are the trends in terms of the hermeneutics of data as we look at it?
Well, I think one of the things, and I think it's an excellent point you bring up, Ryan, is that the data can only assess certain things. The data cannot assess the condition of our souls. The data cannot assess whether we have peace of mind. The data cannot assess whether we are people of integrity. And I think that while the numbers show that in terms of perhaps finances, perhaps inflation, perhaps in terms of the job market, we are in a positive direction, the data is not assessing how we feel about that. We may have a new job, but if we hate the new job and we don't feel that we're walking in God's vision for our life, then yeah, it's going to be a positive data point, but our experience of that data point is not a positive one. And I think that we have assumed that data is a reflector of the totality of people's existence. And so we expect that if the data is positive, then of course we're going to be positive. But the reality is that we have gotten to a point where we trust what the data says more than we do our instincts, more than we do the evidence that we see in our lives every day, and more than our experiences. I saw something the other day that was really telling. It was talking about student loan debt, that there were all these people now that are starting to repay student loans that haven't had to pay them in 3 years. And the data shows that in terms of finances, people have more money now than ever to pay back those loans. But what we see is, yeah, people have the money, but they're also making really difficult decisions, such as instead of putting my child in a daycare near my job, I'm going to put her in a less expensive one that's an hour away. So again, the data may show people have more money to pay back these loans, and the data may show that people are paying back the loans, but the data doesn't show the price people are paying to pay back those loans. And so when you talk about the grumpiness, I think the grumpiness comes from people's experience of what is happening despite what the data says.
And if the gambit we are all involved in is allowing ourselves to just live a little less miserably and call that fulfillment, we're in big trouble. No offer comes at us saying, oh, live a little less miserably. But lack of connection, lack of community, isolation, a feeling of shallowness. Again, that's not the word a lot of people use, but that's how they often describe how they feel. Worried about, particularly those in the sandwich generation, worried about their aging parents and their adult children and all the things that are going on there. And then the isolation of polarization, which so often has us talking past each other, leaves people feeling stranded in a way they don't understand what's to come. To the point many of you have made then, for the Christian message to be in this time, but wait, someone is coming into the world, but in an unlikely way, that's layered with the opportunity for misunderstanding or confusion, or frankly, just one more thing put on there. That message piercing into today in a way that matters, particularly when people often don't trust a message coming from people saying they're the Church of Jesus Christ, I think is a high challenge. And knowing that a lot of people listening to this are pastors, they are in for a really hard challenge right now to try to cut through all this with what is good news. And I think that's a real heartbreaking challenge for a lot of people.
So in a lot of what we're talking about, there is ample reason for despair in the world. It could be the state of politics here in our country. It could be the conflict in Israel-Palestine. You name it. We have reasons, despite even some good data coming from economics, to not be hopeful in this season. So why swim upstream of that? What reason do we have to hope despite what we see literally every day and all around us?
And that's where I am wondering out loud of how do we as church leaders be that beacon of hope through the gospel message, especially in Advent? We are in a season, as you said earlier, Ryan, that is the beginning, not the end. And yet we keep looking towards the end as if the end was going to be wrapped up in a nice bow and, you know, we start over again. But yet here we are in this precious moment called Advent that has so much hope built into it. So how do we as pastors, as ministry leaders, really remind people of the hope in Jesus Christ that is before us, that is the package, that is the whole way in which we ought to be looking at the world today?
So there's this story in Matthew after Jesus heals the woman with the issue of blood and after he finishes healing Jairus' daughter. He's walking back to his house and he encounters these two blind men who are following him saying, son of David, have mercy on us, son of David. And they're just shouting and yelling behind him. And in the Message version, it's interesting because the men follow Jesus all the way to his house. Jesus never responds, never says anything. Jesus walks into the door and these men go into Jesus's house And the son of David, of course, we know that they don't have a personal relationship with him. They're people who probably just saw him in the crowd and publicly, but they've decided that they want to believe in him. And so they bring him in the door and they're like, we want to be healed. And he asked them, do you think I can do this thing? And they say, yes, of course. You know, that's why we're here. And in the Message version, Jesus tells them, become what you believe. And I think that is the message. Become what we believe. And the reality is, this whole question of data isn't about beliefs. It's not about what we see. It's not about what we experience. And I think what you're really pressing against, Amy, is we have to be really sure as clergy, as leaders, what we believe. And I think maybe the reality is some of us have been preaching a gospel based on what we believe, and perhaps it's not the gospel of Jesus Christ. Perhaps our belief is not as faith-driven as we want to believe it is. Perhaps it's more data-informed, or perhaps it's more experiential. But I think when we look at the gospel and what the gospel claims and what the gospel brings, I think it is what people are yearning for, a deeper soul connection, something that answers the world's malaise, something that explains why, even though the data is positive and it's telling me I'm living this amazing life, why I'm still not at peace. And that is exactly where the gospel comes in. Because no matter what you may be doing in terms of prospering financially or whatever, if your soul ain't right, you're not going to be at peace.
Amen.
I think one of the most hopeful things about the Advent story is that the promise of Jesus' birth isn't that things will become more hopeful later. It's that even in the birth of this child, the hope begins there. It's a promise of something new. And I find in my life, what often cultivates hope is just that sense that things might be different. The difference doesn't have to already be fully there and present, but the hope that something could be different, that the same pattern I'm experiencing doesn't have to exist forever. That's what I find particularly hopeful about the gospel story. It draws a line in the sand and says, now, let's restart. Let's think afresh. Let's follow this new trajectory, or maybe even a new way of being in the world, and see where it leads us.
I love that, Ryan. To me, what I'm hopeful about is the gospel offers us a promise that whatever is happening now in terms of the material world and our experience isn't all there is. And I think that sometimes we get so focused on what's in front of us or what's in our hands or what we can control or what we're dealing with, that we forget that there is this whole other realm of life and being that is life-giving, that is all-powerful, and that what we're wrestling with right now isn't it. Right now, here where we are, there is something else amazing that is at play, and that we have the ability at any time to lean into that.
Thank you for listening to the Ministry Collaborative Podcast,
a project of the Macedonian Ministry Foundation.
The Ministry Collaborative nurtures a national network
of pastors and congregations
committed to faithful,
creative,
and courageous engagement in their communities.
Our producer is Marthane Sanders.
To find out more about our work of cultivating leadership that makes a difference
in congregations and communities,
visit our website
at www.ministrycollaborative.org.